Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, November 3rd, 2021. I'm your reader, Paula Carrezzi. Wednesday's weather in the Cedar Rapids area will be partly cloudy, with winds from the south at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Wednesday's high in Cedar Rapids will be 47 and a low of 28. In election news, in the race for Cedar Rapids mayor, True North employee Amara Andrews and Women Lead Change Chief Executive Officer Tiffany O'Donnell emerged Tuesday as the top two vote-getters in a four-way race for Cedar Rapids mayor, outright defeating incumbent Brad Hart. They face a runoff election on November 30th. In the Cedar Rapids School District, Nancy Humbles and Jennifer Borcherding are re-elected to the Cedar Rapids School Board. And Marcy Roundtree will take her place at the board table for the first time. In other election news, the Lynn local option sales tax renewed in metro and rural areas. And in Iowa City, Mayor Bruce Teague and Megan Alter earned the most votes in the Iowa City Council at-large race. Sean Harmson will represent District B. More election coverage will be on Thursday when full election results are in. In a related front page article, Aaron Jordan of the Gazette writes, "Early voting up in corridor despite new law. Hot races and money issues spur voter interest, auditors say." Despite a state law passed earlier this year limiting early and absentee voting, the number of people voting early in Tuesday's local elections in Lynn and Johnson counties was up from similar past elections. County auditors said the surge in early voting was due to hotly contested races and because auditors tried new things, such as printing absentee ballot request forms in the Penny Saver and hosting a so-called Friday Night Lights-inspired polling site at a Solon football game. Quote, "Contested races drive the turnout and money issues, in this case the gambling issue, drive turnout," said Lynn County Auditor Joel Miller. As of Tuesday morning, Lynn County had 9,506 returned absentee ballots, which was about 96% of those requested. This is compared with 4,721 absentee ballots voted in 2019 combined city and school election and 2,971 in 2017's city elections. Miller said those earlier elections aren't truly apples-to-apples comparisons, but are the closest available. In 2017, the city and school elections were held separately. Unlike in 2017 and 2019, COVID-19 still has some residents concerned about voting in person, and the races and ballot issues this fall in Lynn County are different from previous years. The Cedar Rapids mayoral race posed a three-way fight among incumbent Mayor Brad Hart, True North Executive Amara Andrews, and Women Lead Change Chief Executive Officer Tiffany O'Donnell. Lynn County voters also faced a referendum on renewing Lynn County's gambling authorization and questions on extending an existing sales tax to pay for infrastructure projects. Outside of her polling place at the Lynn County Harris Building on 6th Street Southeast, Molly Monk, age 27, said she loves to vote by mail, but she was casting her ballot in person on Election Day. Quote, "Absentee ballots are great, but with everything that happened in 2020, watching how the postal office was slow getting ballots turned in, just wondering whether or not I would make it on time if I got an absentee ballot, I am doing in-person Election Day voting, which is not my norm, and it's probably not necessary, but here we are." End quote. As of about 5:30 p.m. Monday, the last day of early voting, Johnson County had 3,817 returned absentee ballots, which was nearly 98% of the 3,904 requested. This was an increase from 2,543 absentee ballots returned, 92% of those requested, in 2019's city and school elections, and 2,225 absentee ballots returned, 98.6% of those requested, in 2017's city elections. Completed absentee ballots could still be counted if they arrived by 8 p.m. Tuesday. Before the new election law, votes still could be counted if they were postmarked before Election Day and received by the Monday after. Governor Kim Reynolds, in March, signed into law Senate File 413, which clamped down on early and absentee voting. Republicans said the bill would reduce voter fraud, although there is no evidence of systemic election fraud in Iowa. Among other things, the law cuts the number of days to vote early from 29 to 20, prohibits auditors from mailing absentee ballots to voters until 20 days before an election, and bars auditors from sending ballots unless requested. Quote, from my perspective, it's the late date that we can start mailing ballots, John Deeth of the Johnson County Auditor's Office said about the provision he feels is most damaging to voter participation. Quote, 20 days is just not enough time for a by-mail voter to fix a problem if they have to make two rounds trips through the mail, end quote. Ballot request forms must be received 15 days before the election under the new law. Johnson County received about 40 forms past the deadline, Deeth said. Quote, we were required by law to notify voters by mail and, if possible, by phone, he said. Linn County had 296 late absentee ballot request forms. The new voting law also limited satellite voting to sites requested by voters. By request, the Johnson County Auditor's Office held early voting on October 22nd at Solon High School to coincide with a home football game. Johnson County Auditor Travis Wiper tweeted about the event October 20th with a meme of Friday Night Lights coach Eric Taylor. To make up for not being able to send out absentee ballots without a request, Miller ran a blank absentee request form in the Penny Saver local advertising circular. His office received 1,068 completed forms through this outreach. Miller said he thinks he's the only county auditor to do this, but others might be scared of facing a $10,000 fine for failing to carry out the state election law. The new voting law makes it a felony for auditors or other election officials to violate voting guidance from the Iowa Secretary of State. Quote, nobody wants to be the first auditor to get the technical infraction, he said. I'm also going to err on the side of trying to make voting convenient for voters, end quote. In another front page article, Michaela Ram of the Gazette writes, vaccine deadline arrives for Unity Point workers. Monday marked the deadline for all Unity Point health employees to be fully vaccinated against the coronavirus, with the vast majority of staff at the system's Cedar Rapids-based hospital now in compliance with the policy. Approximately 99.5% of staff at Unity Point Health St. Luke's Hospital are compliant as of Tuesday, meaning they have completed the COVID-19 vaccine series or have been approved for a religious or medical exemption. Employees who fail to be vaccinated and don't meet the criteria for an exemption were placed on administrative leave starting Tuesday, officials said. Officials opted for administrative leave rather than termination to allow for consideration of exemptions made possible under a new state law. Signed by Governor Kim Reynolds last week, the law requires businesses to grant employees written requests for a waiver from the vaccine requirement, making it easier for staff to claim religious or medical exemptions. The remaining 0.5% of workers who are noncompliant reflects, quote, a range of team members, end quote, St. Luke's spokeswoman Sarah Corizzo said in a statement. That includes those in the process of leaving the hospital because they chose not to get vaccinated, those requesting an exemption under the new law, and those who plan to be fully vaccinated but haven't completed the series. St. Luke's officials declined to state the number of employees who are noncompliant, including the total staff members who were placed on administrative leave Tuesday. Quote, the overwhelming majority of our team members supported the science and willingly got vaccinated against COVID-19 or received an exemption, Corizzo said in a statement. Quote, we regret losing any employee for not complying with our vaccination policy. However, having a vaccine-compliant workforce aligns with our values of protecting the health and safety of our patients, team members, and communities, end quote. Unity Point Health mandated all 33,000 employees, regardless of whether they provide direct patient care, must be vaccinated or request accommodation by November 1st. Workers who choose not to will be subject to voluntary resignation or termination, officials said in the announcement this past August. In total, 97% of all Unity Point Health staff were compliant with the vaccination policy as of Monday, officials say. St. Luke's hospital officials would not comment on the current vaccination rate among staff, stating they would not share details on personnel actions. Officials also declined to share the total number of employees who requested an exemption, just stating that, quote, a small number of team members, end quote, asked to be absolved of the vaccination requirement for religious or medical reasons. Exemption requests are reviewed by a committee and granted on a case-by-case basis, quote, to ensure a consistent and equitable process in compliance with Title VII, Carrizo said, referring to the Civil Rights Act provision that prohibits discrimination. Before the mandate, approximately 85% of St. Luke's hospital staff were compliant, Carrizo said. When COVID-19 vaccines first received emergency use authorization by federal health officials, Unity Point Health provided, quote, extensive and ongoing education, end quote, Carrizo said, which included virtual town halls led by clinical experts, as well as one-on-one conversations between leaders and staff. Quote, as we move forward, we continue to emphasize the importance of getting vaccinated against COVID-19, Carrizo said. For those in our communities who are eligible, receiving the vaccine is the best way to help keep healthcare workers healthy so our teams can focus on providing care to those who need it most. End quote. In other top stories, Diana Nolan of the Gazette writes, Cedar Rapids couple donate $4.5 million to college and opera. Gift from John and Diane Smith will boost educational programs at Cornell and the Cedar Rapids Opera. Two educational programs will be able to expand their programming thanks to a $4.5 million donation from John and Diane Smith of Cedar Rapids. The gifts will establish two new funds through the Greater Cedar Rapids Community Foundation, with $4 million going to the Cornell College Ingenuity Fund and $500,000 going to the Cedar Rapids Opera Young Artists Program Fund, the largest gift the opera has received. Both organizations played important roles in the couple's lives. John Smith, chairman of the board at CRST International and executive chairman of Hillcrest Holdings, earned a bachelor's degree in economics and business at Cornell College in 1971, followed by an MBA from Cornell University in 1974. He has served on the Cornell College board since 2004. Diane Smith, a former teacher, is a founding member of Cedar Rapids Opera and serves on the board of CRST and Hillcrest Holdings. The latter is a family-owned investment company whose core legacy business is the CRST transportation firm started in 1955 by John Smith's parents, the late Harold and Miriam Smith. Cornell Gift. The Cornell Gift will support the school's Ingenuity curriculum and Ingenuity in Action experiences in which students embark on internships, research opportunities, or off-campus courses. The curriculum, implemented in 2020-2021, quote, helps our students focus on the abilities and skills that all employers and graduate schools want in college graduates, President Jonathan Brand said in a prepared statement. It mirrors an off-campus experience that John Smith, then 19 or 20, had when a professor took a class to Chicago for the weekend to learn more about poverty in America. He and another student posed as a husband and wife looking for a place to stay, quote, in a rough part of the city, end quote. Quote, it was quite an eye-opener for a young person, Smith said. Quote, it transformed my life. I want to see the same thing happen for the current students. I want them to have transformational experiences, and I think this Ingenuity program will be one, end quote. Opera Gift. The Smiths also have been major supporters of Cedar Rapids Opera since Daniel Kleinknecht founded the arts organization in 1998. Quote, three women were instrumental in forming the public part of Cedar Rapids Opera, Kleinknecht said. Quote, Diane Smith, Carla Gettle, and the late Judy O'Donnell. Diane was a charter board member, and the Smiths have been consistent givers every year in our 24 years. The Smiths' support has been extremely vital to our success from day one, he said. The Young Artist Program, renamed the Cedar Rapids Opera Smith Young Artist Program, was added in 2003 to give college students and recent graduates paid roles on stage and in school outreach performances, as well as master classes to enhance their opera education. Quote, this gift will allow us to grow in specific ways, said Kleinknecht, Cedar Rapids Opera's artistic director. Quote, we'll be able to add consistently more master classes for our young artists when they're in town. There are possibilities we could add smaller things to our repertoire. That could help the whole community see what they see in the opera company, and hopefully that gift will help us find other such gifts in the future." End quote. Gift distribution. Because the donations are channeled through the Greater Cedar Rapids Community Foundation, they will be distributed yearly. The current distribution rate is 4.5% of the balance of the fund. Since the new fund was established in the fourth quarter, Cedar Rapids Opera will receive 1/4 of that amount in 2022. Once the fund is in place for a full year, the organization will receive about $22,500. Cornell has opted to hold its distribution until the end of its Ingenuity fundraising campaign. Quote, "By the time they take a distribution, it is likely that the fund will have grown, so it is difficult to estimate that amount right now," noted Corrine Ramler, the Community Foundation's Vice President of Marketing and Communications. In another Iowa Today article, Kara Smith of the Quad Cities Times Union writes, UAW union members voting on proposed DEER contract. Union workers at Deere & Company began voting Tuesday on the proposed contract between the company and United Automobile, Aerospace, and Agricultural Implement Workers of America. The union and Deere officials reached a tentative six-year agreement Saturday. The contract, if approved, would cover about 10,100 production and maintenance employees at 12 facilities in Iowa, Illinois, and Kansas. Ratification voting is handled by each local. In Davenport, local 281 union members from Deere's Davenport Works gathered outside the Mississippi Valley Fairgrounds to cast their votes. Strike duties were suspended during the voting, but were to resume after 2 p.m. and continue until ballots are counted for all 11 locals. If the contract is ratified, the strike will end with the notification of results. Both sides declined to comment on the proposed contract, saying they would respect the process. The new tentative agreement offers improved wages and benefits from the initial agreement, which union members overwhelmingly voted down October 10th, prompting the strike, now in its 20th day. Here are some of the details of the proposed contract workers are voting on. Wages. According to a contract summary, workers would receive an immediate 10% increase in wages in the first year and an additional 5% in the third and fifth years. Some of that increase is tied to inflation through cost of living adjustments, which have the potential to change. The cost of living clause allows for adjustments every 3 months. The first adjustment would be effective in December. On the off years of the contract, the second, fourth, and sixth year, workers would get 3% lump sum payments. Upon ratification of the contract, workers would receive an $8,500 bonus. Healthcare. No changes are proposed in health insurance. Workers will continue to pay no premiums and have no deductibles or copays. Union members would receive 2 weeks of fully paid parental leave. The insurance would cover autism care and vision costs, including exams, frames, and lenses. New hires would receive health care coverage after 30 days of employment on the first day of the following month. Retirement. Current and future union workers would choose between the Traditional Plus and Choice Plus retirement plans. The Traditional Plus plan allows employees to have defined benefits pension, an increased multiplier for monthly pension for each year of service, and employees would fully own their pension after 3 years of service. The Traditional Plus plan's post-retirement health care fund offers cash balance savings. There also will be $2,000 of seed money per year of service. The Choice Plus plan includes a dollar-for-dollar 401k match up to 6% for 2022, then a 70-cent to $1 match each year after. The exact match amount would be determined based on company profits. Deere also will contribute 5% of employees' annual wages to their 401k. The retirement bonus for both plans would total $37,500 for 10 to 24 years of service and $50,000 for 25 years or more. In world news in today's Gazette, the Associated Press reports, leaders vow to protect forests, plug methane leaks at climate summit. World leaders promise to protect Earth's forests, cut methane emissions, and help South Africa wean itself off coal at the UN Climate Summit Tuesday, part of a flurry of deals intended to avert catastrophic global warming. Britain hailed the commitment by more than 100 countries to end deforestation in the coming decade as the first big achievement of the conference in the Scottish city of Glasgow, known as COP26, but experts noted such promises have been made and broken before. More than 120 world leaders were heading home after 2 days in which they received stark warnings about the state of the Earth from Johnson, naturalist David Attenborough, Queen Elizabeth II, and most powerfully, the people of countries and regions already facing climate upheaval. Johnson said at a news conference that it was important to, quote, guard against false hope, end quote, but added that he was, quote, cautiously optimistic, end quote, about the outcome of the talks. The conference aims to keep the world on track to limit global warming to 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit above pre-industrial levels, the goal set at the Paris Climate Conference 6 years ago. Johnson had a message for negotiators from around the globe who will strain over the next 10 days to turn politicians' climate promises into reality. Quote, the eyes of the population of the world are on you, end quote. The UK said it has received pledges from leaders representing more than 85% of the world's forests to halt and reverse deforestation by 2030. Among them are several countries with massive forests, including Brazil, China, Colombia, Congo, Indonesia, Russia, and the United States. More than $19 billion in public and private funds have been pledged toward the plan. Let's turn now to the Insight page in Wednesday's Gazette. At the top of the page is a guest editorial from Tuesday's Washington Post. It's titled, Rights at Stake in Texas Case. The Supreme Court heard arguments Monday in what is being called an abortion case. In fact, its implications are far broader. The justices will determine whether states can infringe constitutional rights while courts watch impotently. The hearing involved Texas's Senate Bill 8 abortion law, which the state legislature drafted specifically to avoid judicial review before it took effect. The law bars abortions after fetal heart activity is present, which is about 6 weeks. Many women do not know they are pregnant at that stage. Under normal circumstances, abortion providers would sue the state officials responsible for enforcing such a ban, and federal courts would immediately strike down such a blatant violation of Roe v. Wade. But Texas's law charges no state entity with enforcing it. Instead, the law empowers private citizens to sue anyone involved in performing a restricted abortion. The point is to provide abortion providers no obvious person to sue to stop the law before it chills abortion access across Texas. If state officers are not responsible for enforcing it, courts have no specific party to instruct to stand down. Once someone performs an abortion and is sued for it, that defendant can raise a constitutional challenge as their case is adjudicated. In fact, lawsuits have already been filed against a Texas abortion doctor who defied the law. But sorting that out could take a long time. Texas women's abortion rights are being infringed every day the law remains in force. On Monday, abortion providers and the federal government argued that Texas's brazen end-run around judicial review cannot be legal. If the justices fail to condemn the state's scheme, Justice Elena Kagan argued, quote, we would live in a very different world from the world we live in today. Essentially, we would be inviting states, all 50 of them, with respect to their own preferred constitutional rights, to try to nullify the law this court has laid down, Kagan said. There is nothing the Supreme Court can do about it. Guns, same-sex marriage, religious rights, whatever you don't like, end quote. Many on the court appeared troubled. Justice Brett Kavanaugh said the state was exploiting a so-called loophole. Justice Amy Coney Barrett lamented that abortion providers could not get adequate judicial review. The court must close this loophole. Again, this is a guest editorial from Tuesday's Washington Post, printed in Wednesday's Cedar Rapids Gazette. In community letters, Paul Deaton of Solon writes, time for Republicans to act on climate change. We witnessed climate change in eastern Iowa. For me, it's personal. The 1993 flood delayed progress building our home as we moved from Indiana. We experienced multiple straight-line wind events that damaged the house, uprooted trees, blew down large branches, and tore through our neighborhood. Record flooding in 2008 filled much of the Iowa and Cedar River basins, backing up water into the Lake McBride watershed to within 100 yards of our home. it made roads around us impassable and devastated many nearby places. Record drought in 2012 made life outdoors miserable. It negatively impacted crops. Corn yield in Johnson County decreased from 171.9 bushels per acre in 2011 to 132.4 in 2012, a 23% drop. There was a derecho on August 10, 2020. In our yard, it took down one tree and damaged several others. My greenhouse lifted into the air like Dorothy's farmhouse in The Wizard of Oz. Winds up to 140 miles per hour destroyed 70% of the tree canopy in Cedar Rapids. I know about climate change from living it, as do most Iowans. It's time for our Republican members of Congress to work with Democrats and take action to mitigate it. Signed, Paul Deaton of Solon. Also on the Insight page, Gazette editorial fellow Patricia Patnode writes, "Superhero storylines are evolving." Superman was America's first successful comic book superhero. He debuted in Action Comics No. 1 in June 1938 and still is a pervasive force in American popular culture. An iconic American force, the alien from Krypton identifies as Clark Kent during business hours, working as an investigative journalist at the Daily Planet, uncovering corruption with his damsel often in distress, Lois Lane. As the profession of journalism has shifted from independent and fearless truth warriors to overstretched writers vying for survival clicks in a liberal media landscape, so has Superman's job description. In Action Comics No. 900 in April 2011, Superman identified himself as a global citizen instead of as an American. He cut the American line from his motto of Defender of Truth, Justice, and the American Way, end quote. At the time, many expressed anger over this nationality change, citing it as evidence that American pride and culture was under attack from globalist influence. Taking another step further away from Superman's assumed socially traditional values, a few weeks ago, DC announced Superman's son would engage in a same-sex relationship in the series Superman, Son of Kal-El. The media reaction was mixed. Writers from NPR and The Guardian cited this as a big step for the character's canon and a positive representative for the LGBTQ+ community, while writers at The Daily Signal and The Daily Wire expressed exasperation at the performative celebration of this storyline. Ironically, sexual assault, abuse, drug use, and a variety of other awful and racy behavior has persistently been depicted in comic books generally, and the DC universe is no exception. If people are outraged at someone being gay because they perceive that to be, quote, bad, end quote, behavior, why weren't they upset sooner by actual, objectively bad behavior that's been mainstream for years? There have been gay characters prominently featured in DC Comics since 1988. What makes the sexual identity of this superhero so notable? As a former farm boy, Superman represents the ideal form of a fit, moral, humble man in one of the most iconic American careers, an investigative journalist. Even as a newly so-called global citizen, Superman still hangs his cape up in Metropolis, USA. Sales of Superman, Son of Kal-El were slightly higher than normal, but still barely reaching sales comparable to the population of Des Moines. As an actual full-time Justice League and DC Comics fan, it's hilarious to see hundreds of tweets, articles, and interviews about a topic that no one will be genuinely invested in once the public interest passes. Shows like Young Justice and Titans have been writing gay and non-binary characters for multiple seasons, and their comic book source material has existed for decades. Why weren't these stories news? The short answer is, comic books have a small audience, and media personalities only care when it serves their agenda. The Washington Post doesn't care about Superman's thoughtful character development in the new season of Young Justice on HBO. People will care about someone who is iconically American, exhibiting a behavior they want evangelized, and quickly abandon the topic when it's no longer attention-grabbing. Again, this is the opinion of Patricia Patnode, a Gazette editorial fellow. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, November 3rd, 2021, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Richard Allen Oberreuter, known as Dick or Obi, aged 82, of Cedar Rapids, peacefully went to be with the Lord on Monday, November 1st, surrounded by family. Memorial service is 10:30 a.m. Thursday, November 4th, at Prairie View Christian Church in Norway, with visitation 1 hour before the service. Private family burial will take place at St. Patrick's and St. Paul's Cemetery in Watkins. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the family. Online condolences can be sent to the family at the website neuhausfuneralservice.com. Brosch Funeral Service of Norway is assisting the family. Thomas Joseph Furlong, aged 69, of Coralville, passed away peacefully at his home Saturday, October 30th, from natural causes. Tom was born February 6, 1952, in Dubuque, the son of Arthur and Dorothy Herman Furlong. He graduated from Wallert High School in 1970. He attended the University of Iowa, receiving his bachelor's degree in English and going on to become accepted into the Iowa Writers' Workshop before life intervened, causing him to pursue other endeavors. Tom worked for the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics for more than 30 years. Lensing Funeral Service in Iowa City is handling arrangements for Tom. Thoughts and memories can be shared with Tom's family at the website lensingfuneral.com. A celebration of life will be planned and held at a future date. Kenneth Ray Shaw, age 94, of Millersburg, passed away at the English Valley Care Center on Monday, November 1st. Private family graveside services will be held, with Chaplain Wendy Christensen officiating. Burial will be in the Ladora Cemetery. A public visitation will be held from 10 to 11 a.m. Friday, November 5th, at Kloster Funeral Home in Marengo. Memorials may be contributed in Kenneth's name to Essence of Life Hospice. Online condolences may be left at the website klosterfuneralhome.com. Sharon A. Halverson, age 79, of Elkader, died Friday, October 29th at Garden View Place in Monona. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, November 5th at Peace United Church of Christ in Elkader and after 9:30 a.m. Saturday at the church. Funeral services will be at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, November 6th at the church, with the Reverend John Hack officiating. Interment will be at Eastside Cemetery in Elkader. Leonard Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service is assisting Sharon's family. Dorothy Schwarzendruber Gingrich, age 93, of Kelowna, died Sunday, October 31st at her home following a lengthy illness. A celebration of life will be held at 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, November 3rd at Kelowna Mennonite Church, with Pastor Josh Lundberg officiating. The service will be available via live stream on the Kelowna Mennonite Facebook page. Burial will follow at the South Gingrich Cemetery in rural Kelowna. Petersheim Funeral Home in Kelowna is handling arrangements. Dorothy was born July 5, 1928, near Noble, the daughter of Lee and Emma Wise Schwarzendruber. She attended Eicher and Stringtown Rural Schools. Preceding Dorothy in death were her parents, her husband Cleo in 2011, a stillborn brother, and one sister, Arlene Troyer. Marcia Jean Huckey, aged 66, of Iowa City, passed away unexpectedly at her home September 28th. Marcia's family will greet friends from 12:30 to 2 p.m. Saturday, November 6th at Lensing Funeral Service in Iowa City. A DAR service will begin at 1:45 p.m., followed by a memorial service at 2 p.m. Graveside services will be held at 11 a.m., Monday, November 8th, at Pleasant Hill Cemetery in Auralia. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to First United Methodist Church in Iowa City or First United Methodist Church in Auralia. Online condolences and memories of Marcia may be shared with her family at the website lensingfuneral.com. Jean Ewers Nozier, aged 88, a longtime resident and businesswoman of Iowa City, died Thursday, October 28th, surrounded by her children at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Services celebrating and remembering Jean's life will be held at 3 p.m. Sunday, November 7th, at Gay and Chia Funeral and Cremation Service. Visitation will be from 1 to 3 p.m. that day at the funeral home. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations can be made in her memory to First United Methodist Church of Iowa City or the University of Iowa Foundation for Research and Cure of Heart Disease. To share a condolence with her family, please visit the funeral home website, gayandchia.com. Jean Ewers was born August 29, 1933, in Iowa City, the daughter of Roy and Jean McClenahan Ewers, and the twin sister to Joan Ewers Burton. She attended schools in Iowa City, graduating from City High School with the class of 1951. She then attended the University of Iowa, where she met her husband-to-be, Duane B. Nosier. The couple were married on August 29, 1954, at First United Methodist Church. She not only cared for her family and home, but also assisted her husband in their family business, Ewers Men's Store, a fixture of Iowa City for now over 100 years. Jackson Tuttle DeFries, aged 78, passed away at his home in Marion on Monday, November 1st, entering the pearly gates with awe in his eyes exactly as he had looked forward to, surrounded by his loving family. A visitation will be held from 4 to 6 p.m. Friday, November 5th, at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. A funeral service will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, November 6th, at Community Baptist Church of Marion, with Pastor Darren Ulmer officiating. Interment to follow at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery, Garden of the Last Supper. Jackson was born February 16, 1943, in Oneida, New York. He married Linda Marie Christofferson Ridenour in Cedar Rapids. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions in memory of Jackson may be made in his name to the Community Baptist Church of Marion. Leslie H. Young, known as Les, aged 83, of Solon, passed away Monday, November 1st, at his home, surrounded by family. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. Thursday, November 4th, with visitation being held an hour prior at Cedar Memorial Park Chapel of Memories. Les was born October 14, 1938, in Hesper Township in rural Winneshiek County, the son of Lester, Philip, and Helen Blagan Young. He graduated in 1956 from Spring Grove High School in Minnesota. From there, Les's journey steered him into the armed forces to serve his country. He enlisted in the Navy, where he honorably served from 1956 to 1958. Les worked for Wilson Meatpacking Plant. He also served as a firefighter for the city of Cedar Rapids and was the owner and operator of Soot Free Chimney Sweep. Online condolences may be left for Les's family at the website cedarmemorial.com. Karen Geary Wardenburg. Karen was born in 1945 to Edwin and Geraldine Geary, the fourth of 10 children. She passed away Friday, October 29th, at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. She was raised in Harvey, Iowa, lived several years in Cedar Rapids, Knoxville, and most recently, Marion. Karen and Roger were married for over 40 years, were members of the Veterans Public Safety Unit, worked very hard together as maintenance at the Knoxville Raceway campgrounds and as school bus drivers. Services are at 10:30 a.m. Thursday at the Winfield Funeral Home in Knoxville, with visitation from 5 to 7 p.m. Wednesday. Memorials may be directed to the Shriners Hospital of Minneapolis or her family. Online condolences may be left at the website winfieldfh.com. Cora Collins, aged 82, of Mount Vernon, went home to be with the Lord on Tuesday, November 2nd, at home, following an extended illness. Funeral service will be 11 a.m. Friday, November 5th, at Great Grace Baptist Church in Marion, by Pastor Cecil Ballard. Visitation will be 9:30 to 11 a.m. Friday, prior to the service at the church. Burial will be in Mount Vernon Cemetery. Arrangements by Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services in Mount Vernon. Cora Marie Nost was born September 15, 1939, in Mount Vernon. Her parents were Francis and Mary Noreen Ellison Boat. She attended Lisbon High School, graduating in 1955. She married Robert P. Collins on June 22, 1962, in Aledo, Illinois. Cora worked as a daycare provider for over 40 years. Memorials may be directed to the missions at Grace Baptist Church. Please share your support and memories with Cora's family on her tribute wall at the website stuartbaxter.com. Roland Eugene Zimmerman, aged 81, of rural Tipton, passed away peacefully at home on Saturday, October 30th. Roland was born December 17, 1939, to Carl and Neva of Oliver Zimmerman in Cedar Rapids. He married the love of his life, Donna Sander, on August 23, 1964. He worked as a laborer at Land O'Lakes in Clarence and as a security guard at CDS in Tipton before retiring. A memorial service will be held at 3 p.m. Sunday, November 14th at Red Oak Church, 751 King Avenue in Tipton. His family will be present to welcome friends and loved ones from 1 to 3 p.m. Please share your support and memories with Roland's family at the website stuartbaxter.com. That concludes the obituaries in Wednesday's Cedar Rapids Gazette. Let's turn now to the sports section of Wednesday's Gazette. Many of the articles focus on the girls' state high school volleyball tournament. Mike Condon writes, "Dahlfeldt dominates for Comets." West Liberty coach Reuben Galvin's demeanor never changes much on the sidelines, no matter the score. His players were the same on the floor. Galvin's Comets saved their best play for the end of each set, closing strong in each to down Mount Vernon 28-26, 26-24, 25-21 in the Class 3A state quarterfinal match Tuesday afternoon at the Alliant Energy Powerhouse. Now 39-4, the Comets face number 1 Davenport Assumption in the semifinals at 2 p.m. today. Coach Maggie Willems' Mount Vernon team closes its season at 34-14. West Liberty fought off a pair of set points in the second and rallied from a 16-10 deficit in the third to secure the sweep. Quote, "That's been the way we've been all season," Galvin said. "I give a lot of credit to the seniors. They have been really good leaders throughout the year, and the younger kids believe in them," end quote. And the Comets have one other trait that they showed on Tuesday. Quote, "They are competitors," Galvin said. "It is something that we have seen in them all season. We have freshmen, starters Sophie Busey and Ava Morrison, we put in that situation, and they come through big in big situations," end quote. The freshmen may have come through, but the leader for the Comets was senior Macy Dahlfeldt. She was the closer in each game for West Liberty and finished with a 3A state tournament record 33 kills, breaking the mark of 32 set by MOC Floyd Valley's Alexis Conaway in 2012. Quote, "Every time I get a kill, I look forward to turning around and celebrating with my teammates," she said. "I didn't even know the kills record happened until after the game when my teammates told me to turn around and look at the scoreboard. To be honest, it didn't really seem like I had that many. It just felt like we all worked together to get points," end quote. Dahlfeldt said the Comets have been resilient all year. Quote, "One of the biggest things for us this year was to never give up," she said. "I don't know, I guess we just stayed relaxed because being down a few points is no big deal to us," end quote. Mount Vernon had stretches of strong play but could not close out a set. Quote, "In sets 2 and 3, we had some nice momentum," Willems said. "We didn't take care of business and close the job. At the end of the day, every point is about execution. When we lost in the last 2 sets, it was about decision-making. When the momentum shifted, it was always about the serving and passing game. They were better than us in those phases when the momentum changed," end quote. Chloe Meester led the Mustangs with 14 kills. Cameron Brand had 18 digs. Today's semifinal games include in Class 5A, Johnston playing Cedar Falls at 10 a.m., Pleasant Valley playing Ankeny at 10 a.m. In Class 4A, Western Dubuque meets up with Marion, North Scott will play Waverly Shell Rock, and in Class 3A, Assumption faces West Liberty, while West Delaware plays Sergeant Bluff Luton. In Class 2A, Dark Dyke New Hartford faces Denver, and Osage faces Western Christian. And in Class 1A, Burlington Notre Dame faces Holy Trinity or Janesville, while North Tama faces Springville or Gladbrook Rhinebeck. In this weekend's upcoming college football games, number 19 Iowa, with a record of 6-2, 3-2 in conference play, plays at Northwestern with a record of 3-5 and 1-4 in conference field. That game will be played at Bryan Field in Evanston, Illinois at 6 p.m. Will be broadcast on the Big Ten Network. Iowa is favored by 12. The Cyclones play on Saturday, facing Texas. Texas has a record of 4-4, 2-3 in conference play, while Iowa State has a record of 5-3, 3-2 in conference play. This game will take place at Jack Trice Stadium in Ames with kickoff at 6:30 p.m. on Saturday. Televised on Fox Sports 1, Iowa State is favored by 6.5 points. In community news, Trish Mahaffey writes, "Room to relax. Grant provides air conditioning and shed for volunteer animal shelter." A Cedar Rapids volunteer animal rescue and shelter not only received a $2,348 grant to provide air conditioning for its overflow kennel, but also was able to purchase an outdoor equipment shed, which will make room for more furry friends. Lisa Carrara, Secretary for Dogs Forever, said the Michio Foundation, a not-for-profit that supports projects in Iowa that improve animal welfare, provided more funding to the Adoption Guarantee Shelter from Michio's so-called Cooler, Cleaner, Greener project. The shelter's secondary building and kennel only had an inefficient window unit, and several floor fans had to be used in an attempt to cool the building in the summer. The Michio grant allowed the shelter to install central air conditioning unit and eliminate the fans and a so-called maze of extension cords for a, quote, cleaner and greener, end quote, environment. Carrara said the grant provided so much because the shelter's furnace died on Christmas Day last year, which was replaced by the landlord, but the lease didn't allow for more improvements unless paid for by the tenant, Dogs Forever. Quote, "Michio has been so supportive of us," Carrara said. "They have provided grants that helped us expand our dog runs and helped us recover from the derecho in 2020. End quote. The shelter's entire outdoor exercise area was damaged, as well as its main building at 809 Rockford Road Southwest during the storm, Carrara said. With that same grant from Michio for the storm damage, the shelter also purchased a gas-powered generator for future outages and LED lighting. Carrara said the recent grant for the air conditioning also provided enough funds for the shelter to add an outdoor shed, so all the equipment, lawnmower, snowblower, and other tools, can be moved out of the secondary building to make more floor space for dogs. They ordered the shed back in the summer, but because of supply and shipping delays, still are waiting for it to arrive, she said. The kennel area of the secondary building kennel usually holds about 8 dogs at a time, Carrara said. They also use the building for training and socialization of dogs with the volunteers, and it also serves as a meeting area for staff, and when the shelter is open to the public, every Saturday from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. for visits. Dogs Forever staff all are volunteers. They have about 65 to 70 throughout the year. Carrara said the shelter rescues homeless, abused, and neglected dogs of all breeds, sizes, and ages, but also is known for taking in the so-called harder-to-place dogs, such as senior dogs or dogs that have to be given up because the owner is sick, moved into a retirement or nursing home, or is experiencing financial hardships. Dogs Forever also provides foster homes for dogs who are waiting to be adopted. Because it is a, quote, guarantee no-kill facility, end quote, the animal remains there or in foster home until adoption. Carrara said sometimes that might be 2 to 3 months or longer. They have a strict vetting process to ensure the dogs find their forever home with the best match. Carrara said there are about 20 dogs now in foster homes. The shelter is always looking to add more foster homes to care for dogs while they wait for adoption. For more information, go to the website dogsforever.org. The Hoopla section of today's Gazette includes things to do in the area. One is a holiday fair called Joyfully Together, being held at St. Paul's United Methodist Church at 1340 3rd Avenue Southeast in Cedar Rapids. This is a free event for all ages that includes crafts and fair trade items for sale, plus baked goods, candy, a cookie walk, and more. A Sloppy Joe dinner also is available for purchase. All proceeds support United Methodist Women Missions. Masks and social distancing required. This event at St. Paul's United Methodist Church is free from 3 to 7:30 p.m. today. The Cedar Rapids Chess Club will be meeting tonight from 5:30 to 7:30 at the Cedar Rapids Public Library on 5th Avenue Southeast. This is a free event for all ages in which you can join the Cedar Rapids Chess Club for a relaxed, casual game session. All levels are welcome. The University of Iowa Libraries at 125 West Washington Street in the Special Collections and Archives Reading Room on the third floor has a special exhibit today from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. titled Art to Eat By, Cookbooks as Record and Expression. From medieval coronation banquets with elaborate sugar sculptures known as subtleties to the Technicolor party food of the 1960s, food as art has long been tied to the enjoyable and meaningful experience of dining. This exhibit shows that books about food often have attempted to navigate the personal, familial, and domestic spaces of dining while displaying a public-facing image of those experiences. Visitors will find culinary books and other materials from across the centuries on display. This event also is free. In the Mount Vernon, Lisbon area, there will be two Shop Small Saturday events this month. The Mount Vernon, Lisbon Community Development Group, a Main Street, Iowa organization, has announced two Shop Small Saturday events on two different Saturdays this year. This Saturday and Saturday, November 27th, from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. each day. Shop Small Mount Vernon, Lisbon will take place rain or shine. For more information, visit the website visitmvl.com. Today's horoscope, if you happen to be a Scorpio celebrating your birthday between October 23rd and November 21st, today is a 9. Power up a personal project. Avoid procrastination or distractions. A push now can have extra benefits. Take charge for the results you want. Or, if you're a Leo, like I am, with a birthday between July 23rd and August 22nd, today is a 7. Take action for home and family. Your efforts can make a huge improvement. Reorganize possessions, closets, and rooms. Cook up something delicious. In today's Dear Abby, intolerance emerges as obstacle to friendship. Dear Abby, my 23-year-old daughter is dating a transgender woman, Holly. My family is accepting and we love Holly. However, she has been met with varying levels of acceptance from some of our friends. Recently, one of them, Gina, invited our family to a poolside barbecue. Gina's mother told my daughter she should bring her girlfriend. Gina and her mother are accepting, non-judgmental people. Gina's husband is not. My main concern was Holly's safety and well-being, but she wanted to come despite knowing what he's like. When I called Gina to make sure he wouldn't make trouble, she told me she didn't think it would be a problem, but she would give him a heads up. She called me right back afterward, extremely apologetic, saying he reacted very badly and she didn't think it was a good idea to bring Holly. I know it's not her fault. However, I am left with an awkward situation. My daughter wants to stay home with Holly now. I told Gina weeks ago that I would attend her party, but now I feel like I'm betraying my daughter and Holly, and I'm not looking forward to being around Gina's husband at all. I'm not sure what the right thing to do is. Any advice is welcome. Signed, Progressive Mom in the South. Dear Mom, the right thing to do would be to follow your heart. In this sad situation, that would be conveying your regrets to Gina and in the future, seeing her apart from her husband, who you can't stand anyway. Today's installment of the Top Weather Story, a series highlighting history, trivia, and events in weather, meteorologist Kai O'Mara writes, dry stretch occurring at a welcome time. After the fourth wettest October on record at Cedar Rapids, with 6.21 inches of rain officially, it's nice to get a stretch of dryness to settle in. All that rain in October halted harvest progress significantly. These dry days, combined with low relative humidity in the afternoon, fosters some decent evaporation rates in the fields, and we should hopefully be getting back to better harvest conditions as the week goes on, especially so this weekend. The wind also helps with evaporation. Temperatures this weekend should be deeply in the 50s on Saturday afternoon, with potential for lower 60s. Widespread 60s with dry air still looks likely on Sunday. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, November 3rd. I'm your reader, Paula Carrezzi. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening.